Welcome back to DevelopLex. Today we are doing a solo interview. It is just me, Weston, in the studio, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Dan Rose. Me and Dan have actually worked on a decent amount of transactions, but it was funny because we saw each other in the hallway and we had never actually met in person. So probably means that Dan has his head down at the office most days. But Dan is an attorney here in Lexington. His family is super connected, and we thought that it would be a really unique episode to record Dan based off the fact that he is a real estate owner, a large investor in Lexington, and he also is phenomenal on the advising side of law. So we'll get a little bit into Dan's background, and then we'll kind of go into current day. But Dan, if you could introduce yourself and kind of talk about how you got to where you're at today.
Sure. No, thanks, Weston. I appreciate that. Thanks for having me. So I grew up here in Lexington. My father actually was on the very first Urban County Council when the merged government came into existence. And I grew up here in Lexington. I grew up over in Meadowthorpe, went to Lafayette, went to UK Law School, and just stayed here to start my career and raise a family, and glad I did.
So went to Lafayette, you said, mm-hmm. Went to law school. What kind of drew you to go down that path?
Well, I was my undergrad was in business and accounting, and I knew I wanted to get into some kind of business of some nature. Turned out being a professional career in law. My father, actually, though, was also a real estate broker. So when I was in college, I actually had my real estate license when I was 18 years old and sold real estate part-time while I was actually in college and in law school. And then I decided to go ahead and pursue law after I graduated from law school instead of sell real estate, although I still have a license in escrow that I've had for I don't want to say how many years. It's been a long time.
Yeah. And then what actually drew you to the law side of things?
I don't know. I've always been, competitive, argumentative. I just like the back and forth of it. I like solving problems.
A lot of problems to be solved.
There are. And the kind of law, I gravitated into transactional practice. So it's a little bit like solving a puzzle, pulling different elements of a transaction together and solving, overcoming different obstacles and making everything fit together.
Okay. And so when somebody asks you today what you do, what exactly do you tell them?
I'm basically a business lawyer with a focus on commercial real estate as well as like corporate transactions. Represent a lot of high net worth individuals, entrepreneurs, some closely held companies. Our firm, we represent everywhere from publicly traded companies down to, individuals. But my focus primarily is just business transactions with a focus, not exclusively in commercial real estate, but that's a big part of my practice.
And it's probably something you enjoy too.
I do.
Enough to maybe even invest.
Yeah. No, I've along the way, I've owned everything from duplexes to mobile home parks, to single family homes, to apartment buildings. Recently bought some industrial property, multifamily,
retail centers in Indiana.
Yeah, I bought a couple of shopping centers. Still have one shopping center. No office currently, other than the office that our law firm is in that we own.
Yeah,
but I've kept track of what's going on in the office market. I don't think I'd be jumping at that right now.
Yeah. So that's probably a good segue. If you could, so obviously you're a real estate investor, and we'll get into that piece of things because I think it's really unique. There's some people that just do real estate. There's some people that just do law. But from kind of day one at SVN, we're encouraged within a healthy boundary to think about what does it look like to invest? Like I'm in this, I advise people on this. People probably want me to be in deals. But again, we'll hit that in a second. Tell us a little bit about your firm And it seems like you guys are growing. What are the different pieces that you guys kind of hit within law?
Great. Okay. The name of the firm is Rosecrans Cominish Maines. And our office, everybody knows where our office is, even if you don't connect it to our firm. We're a very noteworthy historic home on South Broadway. We're right across from the new Lex Live development. I've been practicing law I started in 84. I started with a regional firm here, well-known regional firm. I practiced there for 30-some years. And then in 2015, three of us left there to form our own firm. Initially, it was more of a business transactional business litigation firm. But since then, we've grown from three attorneys to now we have, 13 attorneys. And we have like a business transaction group, a business litigation group, and then we have an estate litigation group. This primarily represents high net worth individuals.
Okay. And has the expansion within the firm to other, pieces of law been need-based, or has that been strategic based off of what you wanted to do from day one? Or
it was strategic, but it is need-based because, in business, there's the transactional component to business, but also, unfortunately, you do end up in litigation quite often when things don't go as planned. So in terms of having both the litigation component of our firm and then also the transactional department, that there's a lot of synergy across those two departments. And then the estate planning and the estate litigation we added a partner, Melissa Stewart, who heads that division. And you'd be surprised, the estate litigation is like a huge growing area right now because you got a lot of blended families and, second and third generation heirs that are fighting with step parents and stepchildren. It's a very interesting area.
Yeah. Very cool.
This episode is brought to you by Bank of the Bluegrass. It's easy to preach about being a community bank without actually operating that way, but I can attest as a real customer of Bank of the Bluegrass that they are truly in the community and for the community. Whether it's closing a real estate transaction that needs some creativity, troubleshooting an issue where you need a real person on the other end of the phone, or just the simple fact that when you walk in the door, your banker knows your name, Bank of the Bluegrass has you covered. Plain and simple, the best bank in town. Bank of the Bluegrass, member FDIC. NMLS 421548, Equal Housing Lender.
Develop Lex is sponsored by SVN Stone Commercial Real Estate, a full-service commercial real estate firm located in Lexington, Kentucky, affiliated with the SVN International Network, which is comprised of over 1,600 advisors and staff and 200-plus offices across the globe. The SVN Stone team consists of experienced commercial real estate advisors in the heart of Bluegrass. SVN provides commercial real estate services to large corporations, middle market businesses, and individual entrepreneurial investors. Serving the greater Lexington area, SVN offers advisory services for sales, leasing, management, and development of commercial properties locally, regionally, and nationally. With transaction volume of over $400 million, the advisors at SVN Stone Commercial Real Estate have vast experience and deep understanding of all aspects of commercial real estate.
So, yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it really interested me to find out, because I think my first experience with you was Steve Pulliam, who was a previous guest of the show, a huge mentor of mine. When I was first got into real estate, however many years ago, 6 years ago, and I was like, I don't know, who do we even, he always suggested Dan Rose was always who he talked about. But then I found out that you owned property, and that was really interesting to me. And obviously we've worked on your behalf a couple of times. With that said, I think a big theme of this show, or at least with a few of the guests, has been talking about partnerships. And oftentimes, we haven't actually interviewed an attorney, but oftentimes they say that attorneys are the best partners. One, because they think differently often. And then two, they fill a need on a transaction very well and make sure that you're protected. So are there any deal stories that maybe pop off the map to you as to why, let's start back. Why did you start investing in real estate, and when did you make that jump?
Well, I started really back when, even before I became a lawyer, when I had my real estate license, because my father was involved with another local gentleman back in the, this before your time, back in the mid 80s, doing a lot of apartment syndications. That's when the tax laws allowed passive investors to totally benefit from the write-offs that they could get from investing in, like, for example, a lot of it was multifamily deals. And then that's before they changed the tax laws in the late 80s to eliminate that. But he was involved in syndicating several apartment complexes here in town back in the late 80s. And I saw that going on. And then I just, you know, from knowing how different people have accumulated wealth, it just seemed like real estate was, you know, a good way to do it. It's, you know, and it's accessible to people. If you have any cap, you know, even people, you know, there's all these, you know, no money down deals and people that'll counsel you on how to invest in real estate without any money, which is not something that I've ever found works, or at least you don't want to do it that way. But then I, you know, I just saw that was a good way to accumulate some wealth and make money. And I just enjoyed the nature of real estate and owning property. I've always, you know, like built some townhouses back in the 90s, and my father and I built a golf course development, and seemed to attract me. Yeah,
that's really interesting. Do you have any fun deal stories from back in the 80s, 90s that you'd like to share?
Just some horror stories. I was building some townhouses once, using a fellow that brought me, he brought the deal to me, and he couldn't complete the townhouse development. And so he pulled me into it, and he said, okay, I'll build the townhouses if you just put the deal together and get the financing in place, which we did. And then it turned out he didn't follow through on his agreement to build the townhouses. So I ended up having to sort of GC the whole deal. And fortunately, I hired a couple of guys that actually were out there doing the work. But I remember when I was at my old law firm, you know, we had nice offices, and on Friday, these guys would parade into my office to go over the bills for the week, and they'd all come in there with muddy boots and everything and sit in my law office conference room. And I had a couple of the partners like come in. It's like, what are you doing here, Rose? Who are these people? It looked like it was a little messy. So that was... Yeah, I had to beg forgiveness for that. Yeah.
That does go to show that you do have to wear a lot of different hats when you're playing.
No, you're exactly right. Yeah, then nothing's beneath you. it's been interesting. Like the when we did the golf course development, I tell people that was sort of financed with like duct tape and chicken wire. It was like we bought a farm, we assumed a loan, and then I don't know how we got this done. Actually, the person that held the mortgage on the farm lived in Arizona, and they were retired, and so we were developing the farm into a golf course and a subdivision. And then we negotiated to provide capital. We negotiated a deal with the person that held the mortgage. We convinced them that as we sold off lots, that they needed to let us take the money instead of paying them. They needed to let us take the proceeds from the lot sales and use that to build a golf course. And they actually agreed to that. And so we were able to get the golf course built really without just churning the money from the sale of the lots, without really, I don't even think we ever had a bank loan. It was like we just doing it out of pocket with selling off their collateral and using the money to plow back into it.
I've always heard that golf courses are like the opposite way to make money. Like I've always heard that they're a really tough investment.
Okay, well here's I can tell you it turned out pretty good for us because we started in '92, and we built the subdivision. And then we sold the golf course in '96 before golf really took a downturn. Yeah, you could not give me a golf course today. And in fact, that golf course, it ended up changing hands a couple of times. And, you know, my father was a big golfer. He grew up playing golf here and grew up with Gabe Brewer and played a lot of competitive golf. And so he always wanted to build a golf course. So that's how we got that whole project got started. Then after we sold it, my father was living on one of the houses out on the golf course. And so he knew what was going on. And after the guy that had bought it from us and owned it for about 10 years, he wanted to sell it. He lived in Indiana. And so he had an auction. And my dad wanted to go buy it back at the auction. And so me and my mother and my brother, we said, no, you cannot buy this golf course back. We do not want to own this golf course. That was when golf was was going down. I think it's come back now, but I don't know. I don't want to own a golf course right now. No, you could not give me a golf course.
Yeah, you might be in there fixing bunkers.
No,
and stuff.
Yeah. No.
Funny. Really fun deal stories. Let's connect that to law. So, like I said, talking about partnerships, everybody, I think Ryan Foster was the one in particular that he's a big proponent of partnering. And oftentimes he said that an attorney is a really good partner in deals. Have you seen that come into fruition where, you know, maybe you were able to provide a valuable skill set to a partnership? Do you typically do the legal work within your own transaction, or how does that work?
I do. And no, I mean, I feel like that's, you know, people have been willing to partner with me. We just bought an industrial deal, and actually I have, there are four of us in the group are attorneys, and there's like 11 of us all together. And yeah, I basically, you know, when I'm involved in something like that, I like to negotiate everything from the LOI to the purchase contract, you know, handle all the title, closing, lease negotiations, everything from A to Z. And I feel like, you know, by being able to basically just structure the deal and know how the numbers work, though, from a investment perspective, that it you know, it gives me an advantage on, you know, in a lot of ways. And knowing everything about the deal, both from a legal perspective as well as an investment perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, and that is a huge advantage because it just alleviates any concern of like, I mean, you're working for the right cause on this one. You have some stake in the game. So I've come to find out again through the last few years that at first I thought that people would think, you know, they definitely wouldn't want to partner with somebody that wasn't a pure investor because maybe there were ulterior motives or whatever. But now I've realized like people are very that makes complete sense because you have a lot of people that balance each other's skill sets out.
Yep.
Which has been a super valuable lesson to learn. Do you ever get pushback as an attorney? I guess this kind of plays into, you know, a lot of people don't like using real estate agents. They feel like sometimes real estate agents can convolute a deal, and sometimes they don't want attorneys involved. How have you combated that, or have you had that experience where people don't want attorneys involved in transactions? And why would you advise somebody to use an attorney?
Well, I can tell you that I've seen a lot of disputes arise as a result of attorneys not being involved when contracts are being negotiated or other parts of the transaction are being negotiated by not having an attorney. So if somebody wants to try to do it without an attorney, good luck. But I would not advise any type of a real estate transaction. I would advise someone, whether they use me or any other attorney, to get an attorney involved.
Yeah.
At least before they commit to anything in on paper.
What are there any very common things that people miss when attorneys aren't involved?
I think a lot of it's they miss a lot of what they need to do in due diligence. They miss a lot of terms of contracts that that they should know about. Like for example, I recently was involved in purchasing. The seller did not have an attorney involved, and they were using a broker, but the contract that we were able to negotiate, they failed. We were the buyer, and we were in the process of syndicating the deal, and the seller failed to include a time is of the essence clause in the contract. And as a result of that, we were able to tie the property up for like an extended period of time, several months, during which time they had no legal right to terminate the contract. And we were just dragging it out while we were getting all of our financing in place. And sure, we waited for rates to come down, and we were able to get a super favorable loan. And so I think if they'd had an attorney involved, they would have known from a seller's perspective that they should have had that kind of a trigger in the contract where there's like a hard deadline, yeah, for the buyer to close. And those are the kind of things where if you're not a real estate attorney, you don't know those kind of things.
So, I mean, something as simple, yeah, as, what is that, four words? Five yeah, words.
Time is of the essence.
Yeah. 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 Interesting. Any other large clauses like that that people generally miss?
Well, I mean, a lot of, in terms of like how a real estate contract structured, I always like to, make sure you have, if you're a buyer, you want to have all the contingencies drafted in a way to where you've got several ways out of the contract if you don't want to close. I tell people almost the way from a buyer's perspective, the way I like to draft the contract, it's really basically just an option. And you have, 90, 120 days to do due diligence in the property and decide if you want to buy it, during which time you can get your financing in place. Yeah. So I think in terms, also, I see a lot of problems in real estate contracts where people don't think through what happens if the parties get into a dispute and they don't really think through the provisions in the contract about what remedies each party's going to have if you're in a dispute, and making sure that the buyer clearly has a right to specific performance. I see a lot of times in some of these contracts where if you're from a buyer's perspective, even if you default, typically you'd want a liquidated damages provision where you're only at risk for your deposit. But I see some contracts where they don't put that in there. And if you default as a buyer, potentially you could get hung for additional damages. I see a lot of contracts where people don't have a provision that says that if you get into a dispute, the prevailing party can recover attorney's fees. So you get into situations where, yeah, the other guy may have defaulted, but if you're going to have to sue and you can't recover your attorney's fees, you're at a very much at a disadvantage in deciding whether to even pursue it. And under Kentucky law, if you don't have a right to attorney's fees in writing in a contract, you don't have a right to them in court. So those are the kind of things where if you're not an attorney, most people don't know this. Yeah. Most real estate brokers don't know it.
Yeah.
That's not what their job is.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of speaks to specialization. I'm sitting here thinking about the things I have under contract right now. It kind of speaks to specialization of, you want to work with somebody that does it day in and day out and is actually thinking of those things when they put deals together, that you're not going to miss a time is of the essence, but a broker is, because they're thinking more on the purchase price. They're thinking on the commission section.
Exactly.
They're thinking on that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
They're thinking on those things, due diligence length, all that. So you're telling me that those 1 to 2 page purchase contracts that people receive on properties, those probably wouldn't hold up if given scrutiny.
Well, they might hold up, but it just leaves a lot to be determined by a court. If you get into a dispute, I mean, if it's in writing and it's signed by both parties, you probably there is a contract, but the question is, what's it mean? And, can you enforce it? And, at what cost?
And I'm assuming you probably don't want to leave much ambiguity up to a court.
Typically not, no.
especially if you have a lot of money on the line.
That's right.
Something that's really been interesting to me, we don't have to talk about this a ton because you might not have a ton of thoughts on it, but I'm sure your industry has changed a lot over time, and that can vary. But I think recently in the last 2 years, I've seen just a ton of speculation on artificial intelligence and the way that that's affecting the industry. We don't have to talk about AI too much because I know that that's kind of on the forefront of things and it's constantly changing. But what kind of industry changes have you seen over time from specifically a real estate attorney?
Well, probably the technology component of that, of the practice of law generally. When I started, I think email might have initially been you know, in its, you know, nascent stage.
Wow. How'd that even go at first when you guys were going red line on a contract?
But when I first started, there wasn't, you had to basically sit down with two different versions of a document and manually redline it to show somebody the changes. The software didn't exist at that point. And then, you know, I remember, you know, people, secretaries, you know, leaving you phone messages on the pink paper, the notepads.
Yeah.
When I first started. And then I think I was one of the first attorneys at our firm that bought a PC and was trying to learn how it works and everything. But over time, you know, and we used a lot of fax machine. Everything was done via fax machine initially back in the 80s. And then, of course, you know, when the internet hit, what, in 96, you know, late 90s, and then everything started changing a lot more. And but today, I mean, it's like, it's all technology. It's all the document prep, exchange of documents, signing documents. It's all done electronically, so you've got to really be on top of all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the AI, there's a lot of AI going on in law. There's some companies that have tried to develop some applications, like we'll draft contracts or evaluate contracts. And I've looked at some of them, but it's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
They can give you a product that's like, you get you about 80 to 90% of where you want to be, but it's that last 5 or 10% of the contract process or just the thought process that they're not quite there yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I've started using ChatPDF, which is one that essentially you ask questions there. And I think I'm paying like $12 a month. Definitely doesn't answer a lot. It gets you to a section faster, effectively. If you have a 54 page LOI, then you can ask it, you know, something about the rent abatement and it'll get you to the page, but it's not gonna do what you pay an attorney for, which is interesting. I guess, would that kind of go into maybe the speed of deals? Has deal speed changed?
Oh, it is. I mean, client expectations are enhanced where people expect you to be able to turn around things. At our firm, and I think most attorneys would pride themselves on being more efficient as a result of technology. But I tell people there's a rule that I think applies in real estate generally, as well as real estate law, is you can't be in a hurry doing real estate deals. That's a good way to make a big mistake. And I think it's true in drafting documents, contracts, you know, getting ready to close a transaction. You have to revisit things over and over again, and if you're in a hurry, you're just going to make mistakes.
Which is interesting because so many people just want to get a deal done, or so many people just want to get something under contract so quickly. I've for sure seen that blown up because you might miss deal terms that are very essential to the deal, and then client expectations change, and then all the things. Where do you see the future of law going? Do you see a lot of that stuff taking over? Like AI and.
I mean, people are going to try that, but I'm convinced that, you know, for the foreseeable future, probably in our lifetimes, you're still going to need sort of analogous to like the last mile of the connection to the home. You're going to need the attorney and the human thought to get you really from something that's acceptable to really something that's really good, like a good work product or a good result. It's going to take a human touch and a human analysis.
Yeah.
So I think I tell people that it's one of my frustrations anymore, like not only with other lawyers or just people in general in business, everybody just wants to just push a button and get something back, get a result, you know, and I tell people that's not how you're going to be successful, is not just pushing buttons. And you have to think about things. You have to ponder things. You have to, you know, go over something 2, 3, 4 times and think it through to really get to a really the kind of product, you know, professional product that people want.
Yeah.
People are in too much of a hurry to get things. Everybody wants it right now, and they don't want to work at it. Can't do that.
which there may be some people in the field that can give you those results right now, but they're not actually going to be those results.
Yeah. Well, if you go, but if you, again, if you go to some people like, you know, like yourself or our firm, I think, where we have experience, we can get you to that result a lot, like a lot quicker. Like if you give me a real estate contract, I can look at it and pretty quickly tell you what it's missing or what it, you know, what it should have just from the years of experience. Yeah. But then if you say, okay, rewrite the contract, I'm going to sit down and think it through how it should be.
Yeah. Have it back to me in an hour.
Yeah,
drop everything you're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
If you were advising people on, you know, a lot of listeners, well, actually, I would say our listeners vary all across the board. But let's say specifically right now to somebody that's just getting invested in real estate, maybe they have a few houses, maybe they have a couple commercial properties. If you were trying to pick an attorney to be on your team, to just be somebody that you just send all your deals to, you know, you have look over your LOIs, all that kind of stuff. What would you say are some qualities or what would you be looking for in that team member, in that attorney as an investor?
Number one, I would want someone that's got, you know, a few years of experience doing transactions exactly like the ones that they're trying to complete. I would ask for some references to some people that they've represented before and talk to them and see if they felt like they got good representation at fair compensation. Those are the two things that I would probably focus on. I think probably it would be wanting to talk to some people that they'd represented before.
Gotcha.
And get some good referrals.
And does that go firm-wide? Because I assume you guys work in a team in some capacity. Like you're not looking over every single word of every single deal that maybe you're on, but maybe you have team-wide help in those deals.
We do. But I mean, again, if I was gonna hire an attorney for anything, I wouldn't want to have one person, even if somebody in a firm like ours where we've got a lot of attorneys working there, is have one person that I can know I can pick up the phone and call, and I'm not routed through a bureaucracy.
Yeah, when stuff hits the fan. One,
you know, have a partner level person who is responsive to you.
Craftsman Contractors is Central Kentucky's one-stop shop for roofing, windows, siding, and gutters. CraftsmanContractors.com/contact us will get you straight to the form you need so that their team will get in touch about your project. Or just text Steven at 859-246-0108. When they finish your project, windows, siding, gutters, or roofing, you'll see what they mean when they say, "We build with integrity." Are you looking to start or scale your real estate portfolio in Central Kentucky? Check out Rapid Fire Investments. They find off-market, discounted real estate deals just for you, so you can save time and maximize profits. From single-family homes to multifamily apartments, no matter what your investment goals are, Rapid Fire can help you reach them. Sign up for their email list today and get notified when new properties become available. Just go to rapidfireinvestments.com. That's rapidfireinvestments.com.
And then let's talk a little bit on the investment side, and then we'll maybe shift to forward-facing questions. Maybe some lessons learned along the way. It can relate to law, it cannot, but maybe some lessons learned along the way that you've had in your many years of being a real estate investor. Again, it can be legal related, it cannot be, but what are some things that you maybe could give some people on takeaways?
Well, I would say, you know, there's a lot of things that I've bought and I've sold that I wish I'd kept. Now, in looking back, you wonder sometimes, had I not sold that asset, could I have bought this other asset that I have now? But in retrospect, there's a lot of things that I bought I wish I'd kept instead of, you know, figured out a way to keep them and then just accumulate more going forward. So I think that's one thing. Another thing is, it's probably just as much work to buy a duplex or a couple of duplexes and deal with that than there is to buy, you know, 150, 200 unit apartment building. It's I would encourage people to look at scale if you can. Now, it takes a lot of capital to do that, but and a lot of smaller deals take as much work as larger deals. I mean, you know that from a brokerage perspective.
Oh my gosh,
it's easier to just assume work easy to work on a $10 million deal than a $100,000 deal.
Which that's just getting into my head.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's, but again, it takes time to get to that. You know, it takes capital, it takes experience to where you feel comfortable biting that off. And then timing, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's some stuff that I say I should regret selling things. There's things that I've sold that I don't regret having sold. Like, you guys helped us sell a shopping center there over in Jeffersonville. We sold it just exactly at the right time.
Yeah. I still remember, if I can tell this deal story, this is one of my favorite of all time. We were working with Dan on this shopping center that we ended up getting sold on an auction platform. And I had never met Dan, but we were on a Zoom call during the auction, and me and the guy I was working with on the deal, Nathan Dillier, pacing around the office, calling all these buyers on the auction, trying to get them to bid up a little bit. And I still remember, you know, we hit the reserve or whatever, and we flew past the reserve. And I still remember you were holding this little rubber football, and you were so excited that you spiked the football. That was a fun deal.
That was good. Yeah, that was a great. You guys did great for us on that. Yeah, that was good.
I don't know if it was us or if it was timing or whatever, but that was one of those fun deals in real estate. But to go to your point, that was one that you were glad that you sold. But you guys did go in there, put decent work in, got the leases stabilized, worked through a problem, and then we're able to capitalize on a good market.
Yeah, and we bought it off a bank. I think we bought it in like 2012, like right after the crash.
But
it turned out okay.
And it seems to me like you've probably been an opportunistic value add investor has kind of been your strategy, just from what I know.
I have been. I mean, I've bought things like that. I bought some foreclosure stuff. Although I'm more and more, I'm trying to focus on, you know, higher quality assets. I was watching CNBC the other day, and there's this guy, Jeff Green, who's based in Fort Lauderdale, and he's a billionaire real estate investor. And he said something that I've told a couple of people, and they're both like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I said, he said he'd rather buy a good asset at a fair price than a fair asset at a good price. And I'm like that. It's like, look for higher quality. I don't, it's okay to buy like an A or A plus property and pay market value for it than to try to find a C or B minus property and feel like you're getting it at a really good deal. And when he said that, it's like, yeah, that's probably the next one. Yeah, buy the nicer assets, and then over time you'll be rewarded for that. Because a lot of those distressed deals are a lot of work.
Yeah,
I mean, and they don't always, they're distressed for a reason.
Yeah,
it may not be who owns it. It may just be the nature of the asset.
And yeah,
that because the guy that owned it before you, I mean, unless they just like had some peripheral issues that distracted them. Most people you deal with, most people are pretty average or above average intelligence in the real estate business. It's like, if he couldn't wake at work, why do you think you can?
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. That's hilarious. That's probably the quote of the episode. Okay, well, let's maybe move to some forward facing questions as we come up on our time here. Obviously, you've been a Lexingtonian for a very, very long time. We're in a Lexington-based podcast, so we do try to direct it towards Lexington and in some capacity. So what is a thing that you feel like Lexington, the year 2023, can begin to do better, maybe as it relates to real estate? It doesn't have to necessarily relate to real estate, but what would you like to see changed in Lexington that you could maybe evoke some people of the younger generation to push along?
Okay, well,
it doesn't have to be about the urban service boundary, too, by the way.
Well, that's okay. No, because actually, I wouldn't mind talking about that now. You just open the floor. Okay, so I probably have a different view of this than most people. I'm of the opinion that start from the premise that like Lexington is a very nice community, and it has some qualities that are very unique, not just in the United States, but worldwide, in terms of like the nature that we have, the horse industry, the natural resources, the water that Central Kentucky has with the Kentucky River and the fresh water, and just the lifestyle. And I compare it, some people make fun of me when I say this, but I mean, I feel like over the next 20 or 30 years that we can be like Aspen or Malibu or, the Hamptons, Martha's Vineyard. I mean, we can be a garden spot in the United States with a really high quality of life, but we can't do that and keep adding people to within Fayette County. Yeah. And maybe even really within the Fayette and the contiguous counties. So I'm not a big proponent of expanding any of the urban service boundary or of any really, attempt to expand the population of Lexington. I don't think our goal should be to expand the population of Lexington. I think it should be to expand, improve the quality of life, improve the infrastructure, and try to enhance the quality of the jobs we have. I mean, we have with UK and Transy and all the higher education and the medical center. I mean, I don't think we need to keep adding ground to the urban service boundary and try to keep bringing in additional jobs and build additional, Masterson Station subdivisions or anything like that. I think we ought to greatly restrict growth, like a lot of places like Aspen and those places. They don't allow any growth, and they realize that if they grow, they're going to destroy what they have. And I think that's going to happen to Fayette County. I mean, if you run the numbers, I mean, if we kept expanding at the rate we've expanded and the population's grown in the last 50 years, in another 50 years, we'll just be Nowheresville, USA. There won't be anything here that'll matter. We'll just be like another medium-sized town in the Midwest of the United States.
With a lost identity.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And you talk to some of the people here, I know some of the powers that be say, well, if we don't grow, then our tax base isn't going to grow. We need more tax revenue to pay for all this stuff. And I think they've got it completely backwards. I think if you look back, actually, both our property taxes and the occupational tax are higher now than they've ever been. And I think the growth is what's causing the taxes to go up. The growth is not providing the revenue to reduce the tax burden on each person. It's increasing it.
I mean, a different perspective, but not one that's necessarily unique. I do think that there are a lot of people that are in that same camp. And you do raise a good point. At what point do we lose the identity of Lexington?
Yeah. I've asked the mayor and some other people, and I can't get a straight answer to this question. It's like, how many people do we want? Like, what is the maximum capacity of Fayette County in terms of people that live here? And nobody can give you a straight answer. I mean, there is a limit.
Yeah. What's the goal? Okay. And then I would say my follow-up question is what are you most excited for with the future of Lexington? Is there anything? It can be real estate related. It can be just quality of life related. Is there anything that gets you excited right now?
No, I just think it's a great place to live and, have a family. And there's... I do worry a little bit, though, that there's this mindless pro-growth mood among a lot of the people, especially on the Urban County Council. It's like, oh, we just need to grow. Let's grow. Why? I mean, I don't understand why if the government's supposed to be interested in the well-being of the people that live here now, what advantage is there to us that are here now to continue to grow and grow and grow more and more people here? It's not helping the people that live here now. You're actually going to destroy their quality of life.
Hey, this is not a pro Lexington podcast or an anti Lexington podcast. This is a podcast to get conversations started. So that's what it is. So, well, Dan, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for what you've done for the city of Lexington over the last however many years. Yeah, just thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Weston. Appreciate it.
Develop Lex is a part of the Middle Tech family of brands. This episode is edited by Jacob Spencer. Ellie McCarthy creates our social content that serves you daily.